Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today marks the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. I've called Gettysburg and tried to find out exactly what time Abraham Lincoln gave this address, and nobody seems to know. It was sometime in the afternoon, so I'd like to think it was right about now. We're going to commemorate that day this hour with two guests, Professor Douglas Wilson, who is co-director of the Lincoln Studies Center at Knox College in Illinois, later with the author of Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. Kevin Perino will be joining us. But first, you can't talk about the Gettysburg Address without listening to it. Of all the readings that I have heard, this is the best that I have found from Atticus Finch. Who best to read? Gregory Peck.
Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Gregory Peck reading the Gettysburg Address delivered 150 years ago today, perhaps one of the most famous speeches in the history of delivering speeches, delivered as part of the dedication ceremonies of the Soldiers National Cemetery in Gettysburg, a full 4.5 months after the battle was fought. You probably know that Lincoln was not the keynote speaker. Edward Everett, a well-known orator who had been a state senator, governor of Massachusetts, and secretary of state, was the keynote speaker, and Lincoln was invited to attend to dedicate the land. Our first guest this hour is Professor Douglas Wilson, Professor Emeritus and co-director of the Lincoln Studies Center at Knox College in Illinois. We had the pleasure of listening to him when he spoke to a group of listeners who accompanied us to Springfield, Illinois several years ago. We had a wonderful trip. He has written extensively about Lincoln, is the two-time recipient of the Lincoln Prize for published books, among his books Lincoln's Sword, The Presidency and the Power of Words, and Honor's Voice, The Transformation of Abraham Lincoln, many, many other writings on this president. This Thursday at 6 o'clock, he's going to speak at the Newbery Missouri Library in Chicago discussing the language and rhetoric of President Lincoln. He was also a consultant to Steven Spielberg on the film Lincoln. We welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org. Later this hour, the author of Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. Professor Wilson, hello. Thank you so much for being with us, and it's great to have you on the air again. Hi. Oh, wait a second. I have you on the wrong line. There we go. Hi, Professor Wilson. Great to talk to you again. Thank you.
It's nice to be back on your program.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Why is it that this particular address, when the president, you know, it's interesting, he said, the world will little note nor long remember what we say here. Here we are. Here everybody's gathered in Gettysburg. You're analyzing this. Gettysburg is having events all week long. We sure are remembering what he said there so many years later and probably always will. So why?
Well, I just think it's a remarkable work. It's remarkable in its construction. It's remarkable in its eloquence and its appeal. It one of the first things said about it as literature was said by the editor of Harper's Weekly about 2 weeks after the address. He'd been reading it and thinking about it, and he said he was praising it, and he said it can't even be read without kindling emotion. So that would be one thing to do in a cemetery in front of the wives and the widows and the orphan children and the veterans and who had died there, but somehow the Gettysburg Address is, for many reasons, often analyzed but never fully explained, it still kindles emotion.
Mm-hmm. And it speaks, I heard you on...
feel things. We still feel something when we recite it.
Yes, don't we? Isn't that the truth? And, you know, we have these myths about this address, that he scribbled this and put it in his top hat and he wrote it on the train. That wasn't the case at all. He knew this was a very important address, and he thought carefully about what he was going to say, didn't he?
That's exactly right. I go back farther than most people on this. Having studied his writing for years, I argue in my book, Lincoln's Sword, that he made a practice for a long time of collecting ideas, phrases, examples, anecdotes. When he had a theme in mind, he was on the lookout for, and he talks about how if he had an idea, he would quickly write it down because he might not have it again and he might forget. So he was a collector of the materials of these speeches. And it's very clear in studying his presidential work because he didn't give many speeches. He gave only a few public speeches. He was afraid of public speeches for the most part. He thought he's likely to speak out of a turn, make a gaffe, which would have consequences. And so he made himself just stay silent for the most. But he wrote letters that would have been speeches at another time, public letters. Addressed to the public at large and trying to argue. And so we know we can track the way some of these were written, and we have one good example of how he explained to somebody who admired one of the letters that he wrote. He said, you know, he's sitting at his desk. He says, you know, when the time came to write that letter, I just had to open this drawer, and it was all in there. And he'd been saving up these little pieces. The point here is that he did this when he knew he had something to say, and then he waited for the right occasion. And there's no question that he was thinking about this speech a long time before, certainly at least till July 7th, where he says to the serenaders who come to the White House to celebrate the victory of Gettysburg and Vicksburg. He says, he talks about the fact that the enemies of the Declaration of Independence, who were fighting against the idea that all men are created equal, were met at Gettysburg and they had to turn tail and run. And then he says, this is a glorious theme for a speech, but I don't have a speech to give. Well, you know, he's already working on speech. Mm-hmm. You can't say, well, he hadn't got the invitation yet, because He was waiting for the invitation to come. He already had the speech.
Oh, that's funny. And he had how many versions? You've done an analysis of words that he changed in the different letters that there are on record. He wrote it more than once.
Yes, and there's just no telling how many times. Everybody's agreed that what's called the Nicolay draft has the oldest documents that we know of, and one of those almost certainly written in Washington before he went to Gettysburg. But even that is a fair copy. That means it's not a composition copy where he crosses out this word and puts in a different one. He's written it out because he's come to a point where he wants to see what he's got so far looks like, so he writes it out fair. He did that a lot. And so we know that even there, at that point, there's a lot of work behind him because this is all written out beautifully in a flowing hand, no hesitation or anything. So it's hard to tell, but that particular manuscript, one the first leaf is written in ink, the second leaf is written in pencil, and the two don't fit precisely. So you know you're looking at the remains of two drafts right there, and there were who knows how many before. And as you know, Kathleen, the brevity of the speech, which causes the common sense reaction that it means that he wrote it quickly and it didn't take him much time, the opposite is true. All great writers will tell you, and they say over and over again, the more you try to compress it and get more into it and keep it shorter, the harder it is, the longer it takes.
Mm-hmm. Somebody has said that what he did in this speech was to honor the fallen, to capture the reason for the Civil War, to provide the purpose of our nation's founding, and to provide inspiration for finishing the fight and justifying the preservation of the Union. I think he did do this, and he did it all in that very short period of time that you just described. What a task.
I agree with you, and I think, I don't mean this as trying to trump what you've said. I agree with what you said, and I think you got the essence of it. But I think that we don't give enough attention to the fact that there's a lot of evidence for his concern that one of the reasons that American Democratic government has to be preserved is because the rest of the world doesn't believe it can work, and they scoff at American. And they saw the coming of the Civil War as saying, oh, we told you so. These democracies can't. For him, the issue is really self-government. For self-government, he keeps saying in the 50s, you've got to have freedom. Slavery is not going to work. We're not going to have true self-government until people are governing themselves and not somebody else governing them. You've got to have equality. You've got to have equality before the law, or you don't have self-government. And so he's been talking about this all along, and what the cause is, if you notice in that last sentence, the cause is the preservation of self-government, of government. It doesn't say our government. It says preservation of government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. That is what it's about. It's to preserve self-government. So that's a kind of a big capstone, big picture goal. But I think for him, you can demonstrate it was a very important one they've been thinking about for a long time.
Right. And can you, before we take a couple phone calls, describe for us the scene in Gettysburg on this day 150 years ago, and of course what Gettysburg had seen 4.5 months previously. It was one bloody, bloody battle.
Yeah, it was very ugly, and they had just barely gotten almost all of the bodies buried by the time. They had them buried hurriedly. They were getting them transferred to the permanent places. They didn't have that all finished, but it was still, there were still carcasses of horses, and the battlefield was still littered with broken swords and the litter of battlefield. And the people of Gettysburg had really been put through the ringer in these months. But they finally got it ready. There were a large number of people, nobody knows how many, but thousands, a very large, larger than could have heard Lincoln, in full, but it was, and of course it was another thing I think we sometimes, if we especially get excited about the thing and think what a gorgeous piece of writing it is, this was a somber occasion.
Very.
And he knew it was going to be very somber, and you've got to give him credit because he was doing several things at once, but the main focus was, of course, these men who have died here. And they died for a reason. We understand them as a purposeful death. They have given. They gave their lives. Their lives weren't lost. And things like that. But he has to say something that is proper to say in the presence of these people's families and their comrades. Who came by the thousands for the dedication. And he does. They're satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the only thing that bothers them is the brevity. Mm-hmm. Everybody's startled when he stops.
Let's take a couple phone calls for you. We're talking about the Gettysburg Address, the first part of our program today, and welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Douglas Wilson. He is co-director of the Lincoln Studies Center at Knox College. He has written so much about Lincoln. The list goes 1, 2, 3, 4 pages long. He's quite a scholar and is an award-winning author for several of his books on Lincoln. And here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Willem in Colfax, hi.
Hello?
Yes, Willem, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. What I want to say about the Gettysburg Address is I think like all great works of literature and art, that it's timeless, that it applies across all time to all people, to all ideas. And what I particularly like is that Lincoln called this unfinished work, this great task remaining before us,
mm-hmm.
and that that this, I think, especially the line about the government of the people, by the people, and for the people, that it shall not perish from the earth. And I think that's in direct contrast to this heretical idea that corporations are people and that money is speech. And I think those are a threat to this very thing that Lincoln was trying to defend and champion, this idea of a government for the people, by the people.
Thanks, Willem, for the call. What issues does the speech, as you hear it on this day, resonate with? What are we dealing with now that may have some resemblance to what Lincoln was talking about, if anything, Professor Wilson?
I think that clearly he says, it's one of these speeches that starts in the past, talks about the present, talks about what our response ought to be to the past, and then talks about the future. And we get that, and people get it internationally. I think that's one of the reasons that it speaks. There's a logic to that speak about what it is that we do while we're here. These men have died, but they didn't die in vain. They made a contribution. And what's our contribution going to be? I think that's one of the reasons it's probably the most famous speech and the best-known speech in the world it's international. It isn't constricted. People find it meaningful in other times and places. And I think it's from these implications of the speech. And Lincoln is very much aware of wanting people to understand that these men have sacrificed for us. They gave it so the nation could live. And that kind of thing goes on and on. You're constantly called to make sacrifices to preserve the good.
Yes. Carl in Madison, hello.
Yes, hello. I am nearing 50 years of age, and until just recently had never had a chance to actually go to Washington, D.C., and when I did, I thought I'd see the Lincoln Memorial and then move on to all the other monuments, and I just never left the Lincoln Memorial reading his words carved into that marble, the second inaugural. Anyone who hasn't had a chance to visit that recently, boy, that is powerful language. Mm-hmm. My question is, Lincoln is standing there in Gettysburg in that ruined field. No one could have imagined, certainly no one in America could have imagined, a worse calamity, a more uncertain future. And yet, here we are today with an issue that faces the whole world, which takes the form of climate change. And in the news before Kathleen's show, there was no mention of the meeting in Warsaw. Mentions of the energy industry getting back on its feet after the challenges in the Gulf. But I'm just curious, is it possible for a leader like Abraham Lincoln, who is so personal and so prophetic, to exist today, and his leadership that could take us in the right direction in this worldwide crisis possible, given our media cycle, given the we nitpick over tiny details in someone's personal life or whatever? Is the idea of a mind as beautiful as Abraham Lincoln, could that be presented to the public today?
An interesting question. Professor Wilson.
Well, I just want to second what you say about the Lincoln Memorial. I think that it's just absolutely remarkable that you can go to something that people really have, in general, no interest in anymore, and that is Grecian temples and big, out-of-scale, supersized statues of leaders, and the way in which the Lincoln Memorial somehow wins us over. And Lincoln, it isn't just the architect. It's Lincoln, and it's
right,
his words.
Right.
Somehow the words bring him present, and the whole thing works in a way that just astonishes me. But it works for lots and lots of people, disparate people. And I think that it that's what it brings to mind. He's set such a high bar, and we've pushed him so high. And, of course, we have mythologized him and elevated him scandalously, but still, for a human being, but still, our feeling about him and what he was able to accomplish and what he had to say and how much it still is meaningful makes us wonder about why we don't have leaders like him. And I have no answer to that. I'd just say Lincoln still has that effect on us.
He certainly does. Thank you, Carl. Time for one or two more quick calls. Bob in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Hi. My question is whether Lincoln's Gettysburg Address was the first instance where Lincoln used the word nation.
I'm sure it was not, but I would have to go and look. You know what you can do? It's if you have a computer, you can go to the Collected Works website, and in addition to having the text of all of the Lincoln text collected there, they have a function that you can access called the index. And you look up the word nation, it will show you every use that he makes of that word and by date, so you can see chronologically where his first use is and how often he uses it. And that's often very indicative, and it's a good tool to have.
Do you know the exact time of day? Nobody knew this because I just wanted, for my own reasons, to know exactly what time he gave this speech, thinking that it would be during our show. And
it's about this time, as I was going to say.
Was it really?
Yes, because I'm sure they didn't get started. The procession left at the center of the city at 10 o'clock, and it was very slow going. And it was crowded and jammed, and it took them a long time just to go that, quarter of a mile or something. And then once they got out there, there was a lot of, it was chaos, and they had to get people up on the stand, and it took a long time. So I don't think they could have gotten started much before noon, and we know that Everett spoke 2 hours, and there was other parts of the program. So I don't think 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, that's not too far off.
Oh, that makes me want to cry. Oh, you're just delightful to speak to. I just wanted to make sure we're close enough to Chicago. You're giving a very interesting address, I think, this Thursday, aren't you, at the Newbury?
It's a program that the Newbury has called Conversations, and it's going to be a conversation between me and Michael Burlingame, another Lincoln scholar.
Uh-huh.
And we will go back and forth about Lincoln's use of language, especially in the Gettysburg Address, and then we'll hope to engage the audience in that conversation, too.
Wonderful, and I understand it's free and open to the public.
And open to the public. Hope to see some of your listeners.
I hope you will as well. Thank you so much for being with us again. Nice to cross paths with you, Professor Wilson.
Thanks for inviting me, Kathleen.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Professor Douglas Wilson, he was with us when we took listeners to Springfield, Illinois, a little while ago, and we also had, for those of you who were on that journey with us, I know we'll never forget it, the journey to Gettysburg, where we stood and on the site where Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. Isn't that, it was this hour, it was during this hour, 150 years ago. So it is only right and fitting that we should do this hour commemorating the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. We're going to move into a different area of exploration. There's a new book from Kevin Perino. He's a veteran foreign correspondent who spent a decade at Newsweek. He has written a book about the foreign policy of Abraham Lincoln. Professor Wilson was talking about how so many people in the world were saying democracies can't work. This idea of self-government is ridiculous. And so Lincoln had to prove to the world that it could as well. Plus, he had to worry about European nations who may side with the Confederacy during the Civil War. Kevin will be with us to talk about his new book, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power, as we continue our conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin Perino joins us now, as I said, a veteran foreign correspondent, 10 years at Newsweek, senior writer and bureau chief in the Middle East, based in Jerusalem. He reported from Syria, Libya, and Yemen, was embedded with the 3rd Infantry Division during the Iraq invasion, and was part of the team that won a National Magazine Award for its coverage of the 2004 presidential campaign. His book is about Lincoln and the world during the time of Lincoln and Lincoln's impact on the world, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. Kevin, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah. It is quite a day, isn't it? I get all emotional about this day when I think about 150 years ago. And I'm always, and I've said this so often and done so many shows on Kevin, but on Lincoln, but it sounds like you too found yourself just pretty captivated by the Civil War, and I would imagine pretty captivated by President Lincoln.
I am, and it was amazing. I was actually in Gettysburg this morning, Kathleen.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, they have an annual thing there called the Lincoln Forum Symposium, hosted by a couple of great Lincoln scholars, Harold Holzer and Frank Williams, and they just gather a lot of academic specialists in Lincoln, and it was a very exciting time to be there.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so glad you were there. In fact, of all the places in the world I wanted to be today, it would have been Gettysburg. I mean, you could have sent me a ticket, any choice, Hawaii, whatever. It would have been Gettysburg.
I've heard that about you, Kathleen. I'm told you're a Lincoln buff yourself.
Yes, I love the man. I find him very fascinating. Our guest, Professor Wilson, was talking about how the rest of the world kind of looked down on this democracy. They didn't believe democracies could ever work. This idea of self-government was just ridiculous. So Lincoln had to, in a sense, and I'm wondering if he had to prove to the world and was aware that he had to prove to the world that indeed democracies can work.
He was absolutely aware of it, and it's something that you heard in the Gettysburg Address. On the one hand, I mean, the message that we focus on in the Gettysburg Address is that kind of rallying cry to finish the war. But there was also, as you touched on earlier in the show, these sort of lines about the government of the people, by the people, for the people, not perishing from the earth. The line about the new birth of freedom. Lincoln is very conscious of the test of America as popular government in the world. And this is something that he talked about over and over and over again throughout his presidency and throughout his life. I mean, he was in the early 50s, he was talking about saying, "I hate slavery because it deprives our Republican example of its just influence in the world." This was something he was thinking about long before his presidency. And by the time he got to his presidency in the first days of the Civil War, he was saying the central idea of the Civil War is to prove that popular government is not an absurdity. So he took this very seriously, and foreign policy thinkers of the day were very skeptical that a popular government could survive. Alexis de Tocqueville famously said democracies are decidedly inferior to other kinds of governments when it comes to foreign affairs. He believed that democracies tended to succumb to their passions as opposed to what he called a mature design that, that aristocracies and other kind of governments took, the approach that they took when it came to foreign affairs. So that was something that Lincoln was thinking about all the time.
How much did he know? You write about the fact that he had never traveled to Europe. He really didn't know any foreign languages. We were at a time of increased communication. How close an eye did he keep on Europe, and how did he learn about what was going on in the world? And it was he at a huge disadvantage not knowing, not having been there and not speaking languages?
Well, a couple of things, Kathleen. One, you're right. His background was provincial. He grew up in Indiana and Illinois. He never traveled abroad except to Canada, if that counts. He went to the Canadian side of Niagara Falls, and so that was about his foreign experience. He spoke no foreign languages, and except for a little bit of German that he learned to kind of win votes in Illinois, one of the things he did have was a very competent Secretary of State in William Henry Seward, a strong, competent Secretary of State. And this is part of the reason I think people haven't looked at Lincoln's foreign policy before, because if you put Lincoln right at the center of his own foreign policy, you get a hagiography, because Lincoln didn't do everything. He delegated a lot to Seward. And so my goal in this book, it's called Lincoln in the World, by the way. It was just to correct you, you had said the subtitle before, but my goal.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. My goal in this book was to look at the things that Lincoln did in foreign affairs without saying he did everything, or without even saying he did everything right. And so I take a very episodic approach, looking at those things that Lincoln was involved in.
Yeah. Tell me about his views. I know that part of the book looks at the Mexican War, which I think we don't know very much about these many years later. But he kind of risked his political future on that. He felt very deeply what he felt in that, and perhaps lost for a little bit of time his political future because of his stance on the Mexican War. What was his stance, and why did he feel it so passionately?
He did. In 1846, the Mexican War broke out, and Lincoln felt like it began because of a provocative action on orders from the president at the time, James Polk. And Lincoln was a freshman congressman at this point. He had been in Washington all of, a month or 6 weeks, something like that, and he got up on the floor of the House of Representatives and first offered a series of resolutions about the war, and then gave a speech challenging President Polk's, the beginning of the war. And it was a very strident speech. It was very bold for a freshman congressman. And he wasn't, there are some nuances to this, Kathleen. He wasn't totally opposed to the war. He supported the troops, and he may have given some speeches in favor of the troops, but what he was opposed to was the way the war began, and he spoke over and over about it as his first year in Congress was unfolding. And you're right, it was it was something of a political liability as he went through his later political career. Up until the 1860 presidential campaign, people challenged him on this and said you were opposing American troops in wartime and you're unpatriotic, and they said all kinds of things about him. So they used it. Stephen Douglas used it in the late 1850s. They used it in the 1860s. So it was it was something that kind of haunted him throughout his career to some extent.
Yeah, he certainly had his hands full dealing. This is an understatement. Dealing with all that came his way right after he was elected, actually, even before he was inaugurated. But when you say he had to keep kind of a watchful eye on what was going on in Europe, A, how did he do that? B, what was he watching for? And C, how did he have time to do that when all these states were seceding from the Union?
Right, exactly. I mean, and this is why we tend to think of the Civil War as a domestic conflict, which it was, of course, but it was also a global conflict. And Lincoln had a series of challenges from foreign powers during the war. There was always the risk during this war that European powers might recognize the Confederacy, might intervene on behalf of the Confederacy. But Lincoln also had to deal with a series of crises with Britain, with France, with Spain, even Russian ships showed off up off the Atlantic and Pacific coasts in the middle of the war. And so, he also had to keep from making a mistake that could lead to war with these powers. And you asked about how he did this. How do you keep an ear to the wall, basically, in Europe in the mid-19th century? And this was one of the most interesting things to me, is that kind of in some ways, like our own age, Lincoln's era was an era of globalization. I mean, this is the era of the dawn of the telegraph, the steamship. There's a huge boom in newspaper readership just prior to the Civil War. And so Lincoln is living in a world that's shrinking in the same way that we are today. And what's interesting about that is, on the one hand, news, traveled faster than ever before. He could get news about what was happening overseas faster than he ever had before, because the telegraph flashed it from place to place. On the other hand, it still took a week or 10 days for news to get across the Atlantic, which, in some cases allowed time for passions to cool when there was a crisis. So it was a really interesting dynamic, and one that kind of fascinated me as I was working on this.
I'm wondering, I think you mentioned there were 4,000 newspapers on the eve of the Civil War in America. Do you know how many there are now? I mean, there weren't as many states, of course, but that seems like a whole lot of newspapers.
It was a lot. I mean, it was really an age of booming newspaper readership. I have no idea how many there are now, but it's almost not even relevant, because, I mean, we live in an age of Twitter and,
right,
and Facebook, and, I mean, people get their news from a zillion different places. But I think the kind of the dizzying feeling that people had at that time is one that we can relate to in our own age. One of the lines that I like, it was in a letter from the French Empress Eugenie at the time, and she said, "Diplomacy has so few secrets nowadays." And this is 150 years ago; those are her words. And in the age of Edward Snowden and every other thing.
Right.
It really resonates. Lincoln even had his own. Do you remember this guy, Kathleen, who was fired at the State Department a month or so back because he was saying things about President Obama on Twitter and saying things about the Secretary of State on Twitter, Joffe Joseph? Well, Lincoln had his own guy, just like this, Adam Grzywoski, who's a Polish count, and he was working at the State Department at the time, and in the middle of the war, he published his diary, his candid diary, in the newspapers. And so it was sort of Lincoln's equivalent of a Twitter mole, and he's calling Lincoln Pighead Lincoln, and he said his job, he wrote this in his diary, he said his job is to keep Seward from making a fool of himself. Seward was his boss. There are advantages to living in an information age, but it's also, you're also living in an age where nothing is private anymore, including diplomacy and diplomatic secrets, and that's something that he had to struggle with as well.
We know that Lincoln read newspapers. We think of him reading the Bible and reading Shakespeare, but he also read newspapers, and there is mention of a column that Karl Marx was doing coming out of England, and some wondering whether or not Lincoln was reading Karl Marx and paying attention to what he had to say.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that Lincoln and Marx were contemporaries. They were operating on the same globe at the same time. Marx was writing Capital in the 1850s in London, where he was living as an exile. And Marx wrote, he was a foreign correspondent for the New York Tribune, which is a paper with a circulation of 200,000 in the U.S. And Lincoln read it religiously. Lincoln's law partner, Billy Herndon, said newspapers were Lincoln's food. He devoured them, and that was certainly true up until the Civil War. During the Civil War, he had less time to read newspapers, but he was a voracious reader, as we know. And so Marx wrote something like 300 or 400 articles for the New York Tribune, including some on the front page. So we don't know whether Lincoln read. I mean, there's no record of Lincoln saying, "I read Karl Marx's articles," but he may well have. He read the newspaper, and Marx was writing for it, so he may well have. But the interesting thing to me was, both of these men were kind of, they were operating in a world where the world was shrinking. Marx was an early observer of globalization. And so the nature of power was changing in international relations. You're operating in a world where common people have more power in international affairs. And Marx had his own vision of how that would play out. He turned out to be wrong, obviously. Lincoln had another vision of how it would play out. But both men were kind of struggling with these forces, and that was interesting to me.
We're going to welcome phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. Our guest is Kevin Perino. He is author of Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. We know a lot about Lincoln in the Civil War, not as much about Lincoln in the World, foreign policy, which, as our guest said, was ably handled by his Secretary of State, Seward, but yeah, Lincoln was as well, and it was a big issue because when we think of the Gettysburg Address, I mean, I've heard people being interviewed on BBC, this story of the 150th anniversary is a story that will be reported on all over the world today. So Lincoln was an important figure. What happened to the Union was very important to the rest of the world, and that's part of what this book is about, in addition to the cast of characters who were serving as ambassadors to various parts of the world, as well as some of the characters who were heads of state in some countries in the world. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin Perino is our guest now. His new book, Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. We are commemorating the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, which was fittingly delivered during this hour in Gettysburg 150 years ago. And we thought that we would explore a part of Lincoln that we don't know very much about. And so that's what we're talking about this hour. Before we go to phone calls, Kevin, you mentioned, and I want to talk a little bit more about this. I was wondering, the European powers, which European powers and how close they came to intervening in the Civil War on behalf of the Confederacy, whether or not that really was a possibility.
We're talking primarily about Britain and France. Spain was kind of a waning power in this period. Britain was the economic superpower of the era, but there was also, you know, this is only 30, 40 years after the Napoleonic Wars, so France is still a major player. Russia is a rising power, and Spain played a role as well.
And were they, how close were they to making a decision to give arms, to give support, to really side with the Confederacy?
You know, there were moments when it seemed like it was a real possibility. Napoleon at one point in early 1863 put forth an offer of mediation. There were crises with the British, like the Trent Affair at the end of 1861, which was a diplomatic flap with Britain that threatened to erupt into war. That could have led to intervention if it led to a war. But, you know, Kathleen, I think, honestly, the interests of the European powers, a little bit counterintuitively, were not necessarily to break up the United States. They were kind of gleeful about that possibility in some ways. Lord Palmerston, the British Prime Minister, liked to crow about the disunited States of America, and he would, after Bull Run, he called it Yankees Run. He was kind of, you know, viscerally gleeful about this. Napoleon was too. But in the end, there were economic ties that bound the United States and Britain. Britain was the United States' largest creditor at this time. That was one factor. And when you look at France, as I mentioned, this was not all that long after the Napoleonic Wars, and Britain is France's historical enemy. So the Emperor of France, Napoleon III, sees a united United States as a counterweight to Britain in some ways. So breaking it up is not necessarily in his interest. And I think where Lincoln's skill came in this is recognizing to some extent the true interests of the European powers and not messing things up along the way.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some calls for you. Peter in Baraboo. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much. I just finished reading Eric Foner's the fiery trail on Lincoln and abolition and emancipation, and was struck by the fact that, as you've written, Lincoln was a primary figure in the world, and the United States was a little bit late coming to emancipation.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Two interesting points I want to make. One, the United States was late. Mexico abolished slavery in the, I think, 1814. Britain abolished it in 1833. Some of the South American countries abolished it in the 1850s. So the U.S. was late on that. And you know, for all Lincoln's exceptional view of American popular government, this was one area in which the United States was not exceptional, and Lincoln recognized it. You also mentioned The Fiery Trial, which is a terrific book by Eric Foner, the scholar at Columbia. And he treats in that book, and I do also in mine to some extent, the issue of colonization, which was one of Lincoln's mistakes in foreign policy. Lincoln was a lifelong advocate of colonizing free black Americans to Africa, to South America, or to Central America, I should say. That was a mistake. I think, you know, most people would recognize today. Seward, a Secretary of State, recognized it at the time. But Lincoln was a humble man. He knew he didn't do everything right in foreign affairs. And I think that in itself carries a lesson. One of my favorite quotes is from Walter Lippmann, the great journalist and observer of foreign affairs, who says, "Our biggest mistake in international affairs is the error of forgetting that we're men and thinking that we're gods. We're not gods." That's something Lincoln knew in his bones. You know, I mean, he couldn't forget it during the Civil War. And I think it's an important thing to remember when we're acting in the world, and Lincoln knew it.
And where did he get this idea of colonization? Was this widespread thought in that time? Was he adhering to somebody's philosophy, or did he think it up on his own?
He didn't think it up on his own. It was a long-standing kind of idea that was out there. Henry Clay, Lincoln's idol, was a proponent of colonization, member of the American Colonization Society, I think it was called. It was something that was out there, and there's a pretty vigorous and interesting, in my opinion, scholarly debate about why Lincoln favored colonization. There are some scholars who believe he favored it as a way of kind of, as a kind of what some scholars have called a lullaby to ease the Emancipation Proclamation. In other words, Lincoln's trying to convince kind of skeptical members of some of the border states like Kentucky that emancipation is the right thing. So if he couples it with colonization, then he thinks it might go down easier among some of these border state slaveholders. But there are other scholars, and this is the debate, that think this was just a kind of a long time, deeply held belief of Lincoln's that he thought it was one solution to this problem of slavery. And so the debate goes on. I don't think it's been conclusively resolved one way or the other about which view Lincoln's was.
Right. Dan in Milwaukee writes, he wants to know about Russian and American diplomacy at the time. He has an antique that has Lincoln and Alexander shaking hands.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite episodes in the book. It's in late the autumn of 1863. Russian ships show up off the coast, the Atlantic and Pacific coast. This was, you got to remember, at this time Russia was an ally of the United States in some sense, or not ally is the wrong word, but they were basically supportive of the Union during this period. The ship showed up, and in some ways the French at the time, who were considering intervening during this period, were kind of shooed away by their historical enemy Russia showing up off the Atlantic coast. So it was helpful that happened in the war. But they didn't play a major role in the war. But there were, you know, some interesting moments when the Russian soldiers were in town. Mary Lincoln went to New York City and climbed aboard the deck of a Russian frigate and toasted a Russian ship and toasted Tsar Alexander II for his support. So there are some funny moments. John Hay, the president's personal secretary, wrote in his diary about the Russian sailors who were kind of drunk in the theaters in Washington at the time. So they were a real presence for a period of several weeks during that fall of 1863. And I would love to see the artifact that your caller has. It may well be real. I mean, it sounds like. It sounds like something that could be, but it'd be really interesting to see.
Right. Well, let us know, Dan, if you haven't. We'll try to send us an email, and we'll get you in touch with our guest. Oh, darn, I want this hour to go on forever, and it has to stop. So I want to thank you so much, Kevin. I'm sorry we couldn't do the whole hour. We just had to pay tribute to the Gettysburg Address, too. But I'm so happy to have spoken with you and so glad you got to be in Gettysburg today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kathleen. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Kevin Perino, veteran foreign correspondent. His book is Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. He decided that he wanted to do something, you know, get out of the everyday thing of covering wars and covering what's going on in the world on a day-to-day basis, do a historical perspective, and found himself completely engrossed in the Civil War and in the life of Abraham Lincoln, which is pretty easy to do. So he wrote this book, Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, K.P. Whaley, and Robin Cherry for production help with this program, and thank you for listening.